Schönen guten Abend. Wunderbar, dass Sie so zahlreich gekommen sind. Wir machen gleich auf Englisch weiter. Ich will noch eines vorneweg sagen. Zeit Online, Christian Röpke hat es gerade schon angedeutet, Zeit Online hat den Traum, die anspruchsvollste Debattenplattform im deutschsprachigen Internet zu werden. Und deshalb gilt dieses Prinzip auch für unsere Veranstaltung. Wir möchten nicht einfach nur hier sitzen und uns unterhalten, sondern wir möchten möglichst viel auch heute Abend von Ihnen hören. Alan Rusbridge und ich werden das Gespräch jetzt erstmal beginnen und hoffen dann schon sehr bald von Ihnen auch Ihre Fragen mitnehmen zu können. Und ganz wichtig, Sie müssen Ihre Fragen auch nicht in Englisch stellen, Sie können sie auch gerne auf Deutsch stellen und wir übersetzen sie dann schnell. Alan, again, thank you so much for coming today in the UK. What was decided seems to be the biggest spending cut in British history since World War II. And we're so thankful that you came anyways, because we would have understood if you would have cancelled at short notice. I'm very relieved you're here.
Good day to escape.
We set up a little online poll about the topics of tonight, a little Twit poll, asking you which topics we should focus on. And we proposed, I think, something like 10 different topics. And we knew, even though that is not our primary focus for tonight, we knew that most likely you would vote for the future business models of journalism as your topic number one. Are you having trouble with the mic? Did I bury it?
Oh. Just put it back for me if you would. Thank you so much. Thank you.
So, of course, when you speak about the future of journalism, you must speak about future funding models for journalism, but that's not where we would like to begin tonight, because we think that the Wright brothers also didn't invent airplanes to make lots of cash, but first they dreamt of flying, knowing that this also would be a great business opportunity, and we think it's important to dream up new futures of journalism and then think about how to finance it. To make this a little bit more personal, Alan, I would like to begin with asking you about your two daughters. I think they're in their late teenage years, if Wikipedia is right. If one of your two daughters would come up to you and say, "Dad, I've made up my mind. I've made a really strong decision. I want to become a journalist just like you, Dad." What would you think and what would you say to your daughter?
Well, Wikipedia is wrong. Surprise, surprise, because they're through their teenage years. I would say it's a fantastic time to be a journalist, and it's a fantastic time to be a young journalist in the sense that if you're prepared to live off not much money, because there's not going to be much money around, and if you understand the technologies and the ethos of what's happening on the web, there's never been a more exciting time and richer time to be a journalist. I think it's still a wonderful thing to do. But secondly, I think it's important for young people to understand what an advantage they have, and if they could understand the stresses and tensions and fear within big media organizations, I think they would feel very encouraged that they could do something quite remarkable.
What excites you the most about what is happening to journalism right now? Excites in a positive sense.
Well, I think the potential of harnessing of linking newspapers into the information culture, the information ecosystem that exists at the moment, is just extraordinary. So you can tell stories faster, deeper, richer, more comprehensively, more involvingly than at any time ever. And that's just a wonderful thing as a journalist. So the potential has never been greater to do great things in journalism. But of course it's accompanied by all the things that we understand about the uncertainty about the business model and so on and so forth. But I think if you can concentrate on the potential, that's why I think it's important to begin this conversation by talking about the journalism. It's concentrate on the potential and the excitement, the opportunity, and that is great.
When you, or the other way around, you are one of the few print chief editors that I know of a daily newspaper that exudes such enthusiasm about the net. How did you take your former print-only team into that future? How did you manage this massive culture change that now makes The Guardian a pathbreaker for online journalism around the world?
Well, I think it's a mixture of inspiring people and terrifying them. And both of them, both are there. And I think, in a sense, the fear bit is becoming uppermost now. So if you look at the decline of print in the UK, and I don't know how this compares with Germany, but the quality print market in the UK has gone from about a steady 5% decline to about a 9%, 8 or 9% decline. So that's quite frightening. If you're thinking 5 years out, you could lose 35, 40% of your circulation. That's quite, you know, people are beginning to look for the lifeboats. And you can point to all kinds of models of things that are going on which make the point so effectively about the nature of the competition we're up against that I think that bit is easily done. But I think it's also easy to inspire people. And if you set out on the open and collaborative road, which on The Guardian is the one that we believe in, there are so many brilliant examples of journalism now that is the kind of journalism that I'm talking about. And it feels a bit like The Guardian at the moment, like a series of little forest fires going off as people around the newspaper suddenly get it. And it's got beyond the point where I'm having to urge it. People are feeling it, and they're doing it. And sometimes I'm the last person to know. I suddenly look on the website, and I think that's really great that the science people or the law people or the politics people or the sport people are doing all these little experiments. And you then get to a state of momentum where it just takes off.
You just mentioned a keyword, collaborative journalism. Quick question. Which one of you has an idea of what collaborative journalism could mean so that we maybe go into more examples? Okay, so collaborative journalism, maybe we take the example of the MEP's expense scandal, what The Guardian did. If you could elaborate on that a little bit, what you did.
I'll give two or three examples. But MP's expenses was a case where the British Parliament released 400,000 documents in one day. So no newspaper can get through that kind of quantity of documents. So we just built a little widget on the website that said, can you help us identify the interesting documents? And we got 23,000 readers who came in and helped us that day. So that was one example of collaboration. Another is setting up an environment website because we think the environment's going to be the big story of our generation. And thinking, are we really going to try and tell this story alone? Or will we look on the website, on the web, and see what's out there? And if you, you know, of course, if you look in the, there's a great environmental journalism going on out there by people not calling themselves journalists. So why don't we build a network of coverage that will be deeper and richer than anything we could do, and become a platform as well as a publisher. It's the use of Twitter. I mean, today you referred to this spending statement in the UK today, and I was looking at it break on the Guardian website, and all the Guardian journalists were going out to their particular communities, so the arts journalists and the law journalists and the home affairs and the security and the defence, and they were using Twitter and the comment threads on the Guardian and saying, we don't quite understand these figures. And yeah, and you could see the journalists using people to as a journalistic tool in order to get at the truth quickly. And there are just examples like this happening now every day on the paper of people saying how if we don't try and do it all ourselves, we try and collaborate with the other resources and with people who may be readers or who may be experts, we can just do it better than anybody else.
Now, I'm sure it's one thing for a traditionally trained editor if you tell her or him, let's not just run our new environmental section with our own editorial content and articles. Let's partner up with, let's say, world-changing, a very reputable blog. It must be something else to team up with readers, which of course is something we at Zeit Online are doing as well, but even in our more online-minded newsroom, that needed a culture change of saying, yes, we can collaborate with readers. How did you manage this culture change?
Well, I take a really simple example. So I take the example of a theater critic. This is just to win people over onto my side. Mm-hmm. So you take a theater critic. We've got a great theater critic on The Guardian. He's called Michael Billington. He's been doing it for 40 years. So is anybody going to sack the theater critic? No. If you say, in the first night of the audience where Michael Billington's sitting there, is it reasonable to assume that there are many people in the audience who would have interesting things to say about that play? Would anybody disagree with that proposition in the audience tonight? No, it's obvious. So we're going to build a site where the audience can write about the play as well as the theatre critic. Not the audience instead of the theatre critic. And the moment you've accepted that, you've accepted what I call mutualized journalism. So we're not saying that Michael Billington is the only person. So then we can argue about how we sort out the good critics from the bad critics and the people who are good at Brecht and hopeless at musicals. And we can work out how to sort out the reputation of the... But we've established that mutualized journalism is an interesting idea, and that what we'll get is something that is deeper and richer. And then you begin to think, actually, it's rather weird that you should have covered theatre just with one person going on the first night. And then you think, well, Michael Billington could have a conversation with the readers in which he would go in 2 weeks later and say, you've seen things in this play that I haven't seen. And so if that works for the theatre and it works for art, then you say, well, can that work for politics? Can that work for science? Can that? And you discover the answer to many of these questions is yes. And then you've started on the way to building a mutualized newspaper. And there was a survey last week looking at all the mainstream media in the world, and The Guardian came out as the most linked, referred to, commented on, active website in the world. And that for me was a wonderful thing, because it's about placing The Guardian at the heart of all these conversations and all this activity and people referring into it. And you contrast that with newspaper publishers that want to wall off all their content and sever all content between your newspaper and the rest of the world. And you think, I just know which side of that argument I want to be on.
I will ask one more question then, and I will invite you all to ask your questions to Alan Rusbridger. I think there was a big misunderstanding in the newspaper and the journalism industry, so to say, a few years ago around user-generated content. And it was seen as a way to produce content with lower expenses than having it produced by journalists. And I see this recurring now with collaborative journalism, that there's this misunderstanding that this is a way to actually cut costs, whereas it costs even more. It means retraining your journalist. It means new skills. It means extra resources for validating and fact-checking of what's coming in from readers. How do you invest that money? Where do you get that from? Because, of course, we all look at The Guardian and we dream of being able to do what you're doing and having these vast resources, but at the same time we also wonder, how can we actually finance that?
Well, I've made the journalistic case, and I completely believe that what we're doing... I mean, this is why I'm so excited about journalism at the moment, because it seems to me clear that what we're doing is journalistically so superior to what we could have done in the past. And so I think the journalistic case is overwhelming. But I think, you know, and being an economic realist, I think it is likely that we're going to have to operate with a smaller staff in future, because, you know, the money is not going to be there in the medium to long term. And so I think what I'm describing is economic realism too, because if you can get over this hurdle where we have to produce all the content, and we are the only people who are authorities and who are the experts, and that other people can go along with us on this journey, then you're harnessing a lot of people who actually, their primary motivation is not money. You know, the people in the audience who might want to contribute theatre reviews, they're not going to do that because they want to be paid.
Yes.
They're doing it because you know, I think we underestimate as journalism the value of publishing, of having a voice. I mean, that if you don't understand that, then you miss one of the most profound things about the web and the social web and Web 2.0. It's an extraordinary thing to be able to communicate with other people. And The Guardian brings an audience of 32 million people a month. It's a big audience. It's still a very prestigious thing to be on The Guardian site. So we bring a great deal to this. And so I think there's an economic argument. If we say we can harness all this content, which we probably won't be able to pay for in the short term.
It seems all so logical what you're saying, and yet today I read that the Washington Post, which also employs many smart journalists, issued a memo to its journalists that it is forbidden to Washington Post editors to debate with their readers via Twitter. How can that happen if what you say makes so much sense? Why don't they get it?
Well, I think you have to get over the issue of control. And I think we underestimate, in traditional news organizations, I think there's still a very sort of vertical line, and it's a blessing that The Guardian doesn't have a proprietor. So there's no proprietor, and there's never been a sort of vertical system of control. It's much more like that. And I think if you've grown up in that world, then you bring all these preconceptions about control, and it feels dangerous to allow all your journalists to be talking on Twitter and having all these relationships and these things which you're not controlling and you're not editing. And of course there will be pitfalls and there will be a downside to it. But if you're going to obsess about control, then you're going to miss out on all the richness, I believe.
We'll speak more about the use of Twitter and Facebook in a few minutes from now, but first I'd like to invite you all to ask your questions. We have two hand microphones. Who would like to ask a question? Be courageous. I know there are many journalists in this room, and we will not accept no questions. Here's one. Just a second. The mic is always there.
Oh, yes, I have a question. You implied that many of your readers have something interesting to contribute, and that the challenge of actually bringing that up or filtering it out is the really interesting one. Now, that's a software problem. So my question is, how do you encourage that your journalists collaborate with developers, or how much is software development integrated in your efforts of actually providing a website that works and that brings interesting positions up?
That's a crucial question. I mean, it's partly a software question, I think, this question about the audience and the relationship with the audience. But software is a big part of that, and I think the position of technologists within media companies is the crucial question, and I wouldn't claim that we've solved it within The Guardian, because there's clearly a tension between the commercial side and the editorial side, and it's a kind of sort of three-way stool, and the technology side, and I think things have worked best on The Guardian where the technologists and the journalists have been most knitted together, and things are at the most difficult when they're not. So I think the ideal situation is when journalists again get over the mindset of regarding technology as a service department, in which journalists are going to hand out pieces of work to technologists. If you approach it in that kind of frame of mind, you're in trouble. And so we are trying to create a situation where technologists and journalists work in really closely together. But I think that's a very difficult relationship for most traditional media companies to get right.
Did this answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Great.
Any more questions at this point? I'm sure they are. You just haven't raised your hand yet. Yes, back there, please.
I think Clay Shirky said that we don't have a problem with information overload, but we have a failure of filter. And thinking of that, if with all this mutuality and with all this collaboration with your readers, how do you think about the new role of journalists becoming a moderator of their community? Isn't that a betray of some old thinking about journalism? Is there a new role coming up? And my second question, same direction, do you think there's a new responsibility for readers when they impress, when they express their opinion in The Guardian and when they take part in your work? So is participation bringing responsibility of the readers? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think journalists are going to have to get used to the lots of different roles. Moderation is, I mean, you probably wouldn't want highly paid journalists literally doing the business of moderation, but I think it's pretty essential that highly paid journalists do get below the line, as it were, and get in there to talking to the readers, or the people formerly known as readers. So I think journalists are going to have to. I think journalists haven't begun to get to grips with the idea of curation, i.e., getting a long tail and content that lives beyond a day or a week. I think journalists are terrible at aggregating. They're reluctant to link. They fight shy of the idea of editing. So there are all kinds of things that journalists are not naturally suited to. In a way, it comes back to your first question, Wolfgang. So the opportunity that young people could have just by not coming to journalism with the preconceptions that people who have been in the business for 10 years. Let me give an example of that. If you regard Twitter as the most amazing news source, it's the sort of holy grail that people were talking about 4 years ago of adding human intelligence to algorithms, and it's the most brilliant thing for creating tailored news feeds. I mean, if you see Twitter as nothing else but that, then having somebody in your newsroom who is, as it were, news editing Twitter seems to me a pretty good way of using somebody. Now, I think, good as The Guardian is, if I started diverting reporters and saying, would you mind being a Twitter editor next week, they would reject that as a function for a grown-up journalist. I think if I went to a 21-year-old who'd never worked in journalism and said, would you come and be a Twitter editor, they would jump at it. And I think I can think of really interesting things that you could do very quickly to create rich news sites in a news organization by doing that. So I think that's a long way of saying that I think journalists are going to have to get used to all kinds of functions that they don't do at the moment. And the second question, I think, was about the audience and their responsibility. I think that's really true. That there's a passage in Clay Shirky's book about the period after Gutenberg. Everyone's interested in the period after Gutenberg at the moment. You know, Michael Massing, the American academic who wrote all the stuff in the New York Review of Books after the Iraq War, is now writing a book about the battle between Luther and Erasmus and who used modern technologies better in that battle. And then you've got Clay Shirky writing about what happened to the quality of public debate after the invention of movable type. And in his most recent book, Cognitive Surplus, he says that the quality of debate went down because it wasn't just monks. You throw it open to the public and you get an awful lot of trash, but then it went up again. And I think that's what's happening. So, you know, we can all make the speech about the uselessness of public debate and how low it is. But I think it's getting better as we have a sort of negotiation with our readers about the rules that we want to impose on that and the part that they want to play in improving that debate themselves.
You just mentioned Twitter, and I'd like to, since there are also many journalistic practitioners here with us tonight, I'd like to go into one of those many gray zones we are entering when it comes to working with social media. For instance, what you're doing with your editors is that they use their private Twitter accounts to debate their articles that they have written as journalists for The Guardian. And I don't really see an alternative to that, but it can cause a lot of gray zones. Is this person speaking as a private individual? Is this person speaking as an editor of yours? What happens if this person leaves The Guardian one day, takes all those 40,000 followers or more with her or with him? What about legal liability? How do you manage that gray zone that once a journalist is active on social media, the delineation between the professional and the private individual really doesn't make a lot of sense anymore?
Well, I think it's all part of taking this. I've always thought of journalism, the journalism that I grew in, as something where there was a gigantic wall between us and the readers. And we sort of lobbed our journalism over the wall at the readers. And I think the most successful journalists now are the ones who are completely taking this wall down. And that includes the tone of voice in which they speak to them. It's a more informal tone of voice. It's more like a conversation. It's more fluid. The best journalists are using Twitter in advance of writing stories. And then when they've written the story, they're using it to market people for people to come in and read the story, and then they're discussing the story afterwards. So it's the idea of a story that is written and then stops, I think, is disappearing. So I mean, all I can say is we have, I would guess, 300 Guardian journalists, maybe 400, who are using Twitter on a regular basis, and that's been going on for 2.5 years now. And I've had one complaint about anything that's come up on Twitter. So, you know, will it happen? Yes. You know, is there going to be a legal case one day about something somebody said on Twitter? Yes. But the richness that we're getting from Twitter is, you know, and one complaint in 2 years, it's not a big problem.
I think what it touches is the question of objectivity. Or maybe one might say the cult of objectivity. We still have the saying in Germany that is very strong by Hajo Friedrichs, the former news anchor, has passed away. And he said, you recognize a good journalist, or what characterizes a good journalist is that he never joins a cause, not even a good one. And there are journalistic awards given under that motto. And I think that somewhat myth of the objective journalist cannot be upheld once a journalist has a private Twitter account.
Well, I think that's a problem if you work for the BBC, you know, because the BBC in its charter is something called impartiality. And there are different kinds of journalists on The Guardian. So if you're a news reporter, I think you would use your common sense that you don't bring your opinions into your Twitter feed, but just as you don't bring it into your reporting too much. But I can't think of a single example in 200,000 tweets or whatever has gone out from The Guardian in the last 2 years of that being an issue.
What do you think about the idea of a journalist being objective?
I don't think it's possible. I think it's a silly thing to get hung up on. I mean, all these words are problematic, aren't they? So impartiality is not quite the same as objectivity, is not quite the same as fairness, is not quite the same as balance. I would like Guardian journalists to be fair. I don't expect them to be objective because I don't really believe in it. I don't know what it means.
David Weinberger summed it up perfectly, saying transparency is the new objectivity.
Transparency I like. Yeah. No, I think you should. You know, I think another great thing that the web enables you to do is to show your workings. And journalists score very badly on trust. So if we can say this is how we arrived at these facts or our conclusions, and we can show our workings, and we can put our footnotes, and we can put our links, then people are more likely to trust us. So transparency is good, but I think you erode trust if you erect some kind of objectivity test, which I don't think anybody believes anymore, because at the moment you write your first sentence, or you write your headline, or you choose this fact over that fact, you're making subjective choices.
You are running a newspaper that is in the red. How did you get so relaxed?
I'm running a newspaper that is...
That's in the red.
In the red.
How did you get so cool?
Well, we have this wonderful thing, the Scott Trust, the Scott Trust is a wonderful thing. So and the Scott Trust has been very clever in building up magazines like Auto Trader, wonderful car, a magazine that sells secondhand cars. And this brilliantly enlightened subsidy where they take the money from the secondhand cars and they give it to the Guardian, and everyone's happy. We lost. Last year was a terrible year, and we lost £30 million across the Guardian, the Observer. In it, but I mean, if you looked across the landscape, the Washington Post lost $140 million. In 6 months, the Times and the Sunday Times lost $90 million. So it's not like the Guardian is a kind of charity or operates to different rules. The Scott Trust gets us onto the playing field with Murdoch and with the New York Times. But we still have to, we've got to work out how to make money out of this like anybody else.
Do you, maybe this is a silly question, but do you even have the goal of becoming profitable with the Guardian online only one day?
In our constitution, we have to be profit-seeking.
Sweet.
So we seek profit wherever we can find it. The serious thing is, of course, you have more. If you make money, and I've been editor for 15 years, and for 10 of those years, we made a profit. And it's nicer making a profit than not making a profit. It gives you more freedom. And so it would be lovely to be back in profit. I think we're entering a phase where a combination of economic factors and technological factors and journalistic factors are going to make it pretty difficult for the people doing the kind of journalism that we do in our particular market. You know, it's different in India, it's different in Germany, but in Britain and America at the moment, it's pretty tough.
Before we continue and speak about the future of daily newspapers, the print publications, and the whole paywall issue for online, I would imagine that what we just touched ever so slightly, the question of should journalists be objective, should they even strive for objectivity, that might garner some responses here in the audience. What do you think? Should journalists even try to be objective, or is that a misleading goal? Can a journalist be objective?
Try a show of hands.
If I look at many of the interactions with our readers at Zeit Online, it's so often around the question whether we are showing a bias somewhere in not just comments, op-eds, but in the news we report. I'm rather surprised that this is going over so well, that we say here transparency is more important than objectivity. Please.
Hello, Jürgen Heffe. Maybe you should forget about the concept of objectivity. Maybe it's about releasing your resources, releasing your sourcing, showing what the material you have used. That's all you can get. And this is, I think, the better future than trying one person to be objective. Only by choosing what he chooses or she chooses to publish is not objective in itself.
Thank you.
I completely agree with that. And just to give another example of what I think of as collaborative journalism is a form of journalism which is quite new, which is live blogging. So this started on The Guardian with a journalist in politics called Andrew Sparrow, who just started live blogging the day in politics. And he constantly links out, and he links out to other sources, and he links out to original documents. So it's to your point about you show you're working. Here are my sources where I can reveal them. But also saying this is what other people are saying. So don't just take The Guardian's word for it. This is what the Daily Telegraph is saying. You can't link to The Times now because The Times is behind a paywall. But you know, have a look at the Daily Mail. And I think this is a... it's amazing for traffic. So we did a live blog of the court case over the Liverpool Football Club the other day. In 3 days, we had 4 million people come to look at that. 4 million. In the Chilean miners, we live blogged the Chilean miners, and we had 2 million people. That was a story that everybody in the world was covering, and 2 million people came to The Guardian to look at that. I think it gets over this problem, because 5 years ago, everyone was saying that the web is creating all these little echo chambers of people who are just speaking to themselves. And it's fragmenting audiences, and it's people going to the opinions they believe in. And I think this live blogging instantly destroys that, because actually we're pushing people out of The Guardian and saying, go and read the account there and go and read the account there. And it's, again, I think it's something which builds trust in terms of saying, we're not hung up on... this is our subjective account of this, but here are three other accounts you might want to check, which are really good, and that's another form of collaborative journalism.
Wholeheartedly agree. I think the future will belong to those publications who accept that it's often impossible to be objective, and what we're dreaming of at Side Online, which is a long ways to go, is that every editor has already they have a public profile page, but that you also publish your affiliations, your memberships in clubs and in parties maybe even, and this way you say, I might have a conflict of interest I'm not even aware of, and let the reader decide whether you're fair or not. But this is really a long ways to go, and that's why I'm so surprised that there's not much more resistance to that idea of journalists not even pretending to be objective. I think, of course, fairness is important, that you show many sides of an argument. But at least in Germany, I think we're still quite a ways away from that. I would like to go the... Yes, please.
Just something that links onto that. I was wondering how you would... I feel like the UK is a lot more responsive to this approach of collaborative journalism. And I was wondering, I was actually more directing my question at you, Wolfgang, about... How you think German readers respond to this new approach, and where you think blogs and just this collaborative approach, and where that's at in Germany, and how long you think it's going to be before they're going to reach, or you think it might reach the point where it is in the UK at the moment? Or do you think just the differences between the two markets?
Well, it's this old philosophical question, why is there not as much blogging in Germany as in many other countries? And I think there are some very interesting blogs in Germany, but it might also be a cultural issue that I have heard a sentence in Germany, more often in Germany than in any other country, which is everything has already been said, everything has already been invented, there's nothing new to say, whereas in the U.S., when I lived in the U.S. for 8 years, I often felt that most every journalist had this belief that they have a book in the drawer, it just needs to be written still, and that they have really something new and genuine and original to say. And both cultural strains have their advantages and disadvantages, but I think German culture does not exactly support you getting up and saying, hey, everybody, I have something to say, and it really means something, and it matters. Having that said, we are testing how we can practice collaborative journalism. We just did this project of data visualization, victims of extreme right-wing violence in Germany since the reunification. And we decided to put all of that data of our research online as an Excel sheet, as a thing, a Google Doc, hoping that users would start playing with that data and maybe proving us wrong or starting their own visualizations. And the return has not been very strong so far. But we, of course, also studied what The Guardian has been doing, and we saw that the topic must be right. The topic must have some kind of a David against Goliath quality. And of course, the MEP's Expanse scandal had that. The topic must mobilize a lot of people to get the critical mass together of users who collaborate with you. And of course, we are waiting, looking out for when the topic comes along. And on the infrastructure side and the know-how side, I think we are ready to run at that opportunity once it occurs. But that's just one, I think that's the high-end form of collaborative journalism. We also regard it as collaborative journalism is how we use Twitter. And Twitter is irreplaceable for us by now, for Zeit Online. We benefit from it every minute. A key experience for us was the relaunch of our website in last September, when just like in the textbook of collaborative journalism, users helped us within minutes by pointing out that certain browser configurations didn't show good results for our new website. And now on a daily basis, they critique choices of pictures, headlines. We see that a headline gets a lot of retweets from a user, and we realize, oops, this person formulated the better headline for that article than we did. And of course, it's also fun then to say yours is better, and we might even change ours and take yours. So that I also consider collaborative journalism, and Twitter is a great practice ground for bigger projects. It makes us very hopeful. But we also see that one of the biggest misunderstandings, at least in Germany, when we look at what's being said at conferences about social media, is that it's seen as a PR tool or as a marketing platform or as a tool to drive traffic. And of course, it's nice, and we want traffic, and we're happy about that traffic, but we think it's a genuine part of journalistic work and not a PR tool. And if you treat it as a journalistic tool, then actually, paradoxically, you'll have the best PR effects from it.
I think this speaks to the idea which I was hinting at earlier. So somebody on the online side said this idea must have come up about 18 months ago that somebody said the provocative thing, the story is dead. And every instinct in me rebelled against that idea. And I didn't really understand what she meant by that, and I didn't want to believe it. But now I completely see what she meant by it. And it's this change from the world in which we went in the morning, we wrote the story, we put our coat on at the end of the day, and we went home. Tomorrow weekend, we wrote another story, and that is dead, because the moment you write your story and you publish it, response starts happening, because stories don't end. You know, that's not how life works, and so within 5 minutes of publishing your story, unless it's a really boring story and nobody reads it. People will start responding to it, and some people will correct it, or they'll add to it, or they'll subtract from it, or they'll say that's not quite right, or this has happened since. So what do you do with all that afterlife of a story? As a publisher, you're going to say, well, we're not interested in that. That can happen over there. And then go to the other end of the story, you know, what was happening on The Guardian today, where people were saying we just can't get our head around what's happening in the arts. Is this 38% cut, does that apply to this year? Is this figure? And I could just see all the arts community swarming around the subject before the story was written. So you've got this flexible thing now of the pre-life of a story and the afterlife of a story. And to me, the most basic thing is in journalism is that if you get something wrong, you correct it or clarify it. But the number of journalistic institutions that actually build that into their understanding of a story is tiny. So I think there's a huge philosophical divide now between people who say a story is actually this infinitely flexible thing which has this afterlife and may go on living on Twitter and in blogs for days after I've written it, And how are we going to incorporate that into what we consider to be the artifact, the story, and our journalism? And people who say, well, we don't want to get involved in that. We're still just going to write stories. If people want to discuss it elsewhere, that's up to them. It's a completely different idea of journalism that's opening up.
There's a question back there, gentlemen.
Yes, I'm wondering, once we discuss focusing so much on social media, if we might lose another focus that is a very classical journalistic focus, which is being investigative, uncovering origin stories, and how to get this approach into a new time when journalism becomes more electronical and probably with smaller resources than we have today.
Well, I don't see the two in antithesis. I mean, I can think of lots of examples I could give you where we still do a lot of investigative journalism, and that involves reporters working late into the night and making a lot of phone calls and looking through documents and phoning contacts, and that still goes on at The Guardian. But I can also give you lots of examples of the best investigative reporters on The Guardian who are now using social media. So the death of Ian Tomlinson at the G20 riots in London. A man dies, the police say it's a heart attack, a reporter doesn't believe it. He does things that reporters do. So he walks the scene, he makes a map, he works out the timings, but he's still short of the evidence. So he goes on Twitter and says, come on, there were 10,000 people in the crowd that day. Can you all look into your cameras, look at the digital records, and see if any of you have got this moment, if I show you where it was on the map and the time? And there's a hedge fund manager in New York who looks in his camera and finds he's captured the moment at which this man was assaulted by a policeman. So it's a fantastic piece of investigation coupled with social media. The case of Trafigura, a revolting oil company that was dumping toxic sludge in Africa, and people were dying. That's two different sentences. And there's an internal document inside Trafigura which connects those two sentences, the toxic sludge and the people dying. But we can't get it. And then we get it, and then we're injuncted. And then Parliament's not allowed to discuss it because Parliament's injuncted. And I use Twitter and I say, there's this document we can't tell you about with a company that we can't name. And by the next morning, Trafigura was the most discussed home in Europe. And the Twitterati had found the document, they had named the company, it was up on WikiLeaks. And so it was a piece of investigation followed by social media. Taxation. We did a big series on tax avoidance. We said, send us your documents. And people sent the documents. We said, we can't understand these documents because the only people who can understand these documents are highly paid tax lawyers. We put them online, said, help us work out what these documents mean. Tony Blair's tax affairs. We couldn't work out Tony Blair's tax affairs. We offered a prize to the reader who could solve this. Because actually it was more efficient and cheaper than trying to hire accountants to explain it to us. So there are lots of examples of people who are... sorry, one more example, phone hacking. So the Murdoch organization phone hacking on an industrial scale. And we published it a year ago. And then the New York Times came along and they published it about 3 months ago. To total silence. Nobody wanted to touch this story. On Twitter, it was mad. I mean, people were saying, this is an unbelievable story. What's going on here? The New York Times has come over. The Prime Minister's press secretary appears to have been doing all this and appears to be lying about it. What do you mean this isn't a story? And suddenly the news values of readers challenging the news values of news editors who didn't want to touch the story came into collision, and suddenly the BBC found itself forced to cover this story. So I don't see this antithesis between traditional journalists over here doing this kind of journalism and the crowd over here doing that their thing. If we can put it together, you get something infinitely more powerful.
I also have the impression that you're somehow mixing two issues, which, of course, there needs to be an economic foundation for doing investigative journalism, for working on a story that might take 6 months and maybe doesn't even result in a story because the original thesis proved to be wrong. But at the same time, we would have been really hard-pressed this year to cover topics like Love Parade, the ash cloud chaos at airports and the incompetence of many airports in dealing with that crisis without being able to look at social media. So I think it actually is an irreplaceable tool already for investigative research. Not for every topic, but for many topics. But thank you for your question. Please, lady in the third row. And there's another one back there, right? Yes.
I absolutely agree that crowdsourcing stories can be very useful for journalism. But I think this matter also touches questions of trust. Like, you as a journalist have to trust your public to be smart enough to solve the problem for you. And this relates, for me, in my eyes, to kind of paradox, because some minutes ago you were talking about integrating collaborative opinions of readers in your professional environment, and you said the rules, or I understood that the rules for that must be made by the journalists. And so I ask you about this paradox of trust. Like, on the one hand, you have to have trust in the smartness of your readers, and on the other hand, you claim control for making up the rules. So can you say something to this?
Yeah, good question. I think that's right, and I think actually what I said was that we had to work out our rules, because I think we do have to have, it's perfectly reasonable for a newspaper to have rules and say, these are our rules for the debate. But equally, you have to match that with the rules of how the web works and how the readers want to work. So it's a sort of mixture between saying this is your space and it's our space, and it's both. And it shouldn't just be our rules, and we're not trying to control it too much, because if we try and control it too much, you'll go. So it's getting the balance between our control and your control. On this business of trust, again, I think we're feeling our way, but another example. So we had a meeting yesterday about the cuts. You know, the cuts is going to be the big story in Britain for the next 4 years. 500,000 people are going to be thrown out of work. So how do you crowdsource a story like that? You know, a lot of those will be Guardian readers, or there will be Guardian readers being forced to implement these cuts. There will be people living in communities who can witness the effect of these cuts. And that seems to me a brilliant thing if you can not rely on your small reporting team, if you can put that exercise out to people. So we've begun to do it, and we've begun to say, you know, tell us what's happening in your job, in your community, in your hospital, in your school. And we started logging all the things that are coming in. And, you know, in the back of our minds, we're thinking people could be telling us misinformation, they could be spamming us, they could be... and so how are we going to verify that? So that's partly a question of where are we prepared to put the journalistic resource, which comes to the question that we had earlier about, you know, what does a grown-up journalist consider, you know, is a grown-up act of journalism? Is that crowdsourcing exercise a job for grown-up journalists? I would say yes. I would certainly say yes to my daughter. I would say that's a great thing to get into. But I think behind your question is this question of trust, and actually of the information that's come in. We ask them to give an email address and a way of contacting them. A lot of them want to be anonymous because they're in jobs and their managers wouldn't want them to be giving us this information. But again, the people who are doing it says it's 98% of that information that's coming in is completely reliable and trustworthy. So there's something very good going on in which this is a credible and trustworthy exercise that we're doing there.
Did this answer your question?
Yeah.
There are two gentlemen right there. And there's one more question in the back, right? Yes, the lady in the back.
Hi, my name's Mark Young. I'm the editor of a news site here in Germany called The Local, and I just wanted to touch upon something that you just said. How do you feel about, you're saying about some commenters, they want to remain anonymous. I know that we have on a daily basis some days where I think people, it would be a lot better for both sides if people use their real names. Do you feel that the drive towards people using their real names, is, would that harm social media? Would that stunt it? Or do you actually feel that at some point maybe we'll reach a more mature discussion where people won't feel like they need to hide behind some name, login name?
Well, I think we should try everything. I sometimes look at forums where people, where the point of it is that they use their own names, and sometimes it leads to good debate. Sometimes you don't get many people who come in. Sometimes it doesn't seem to me any better than the debate that we get where people are anonymous. So I think our attitude at the moment is, A, there are tremendous practical difficulties, as you know, about trying to get true identities on the web. And if we can collaborate with Facebook and use Facebook identities, and you know, we should be open to all that. But we're more interested in what they have to say than who they are. And it's a finely balanced argument, because the people who are coming in and saying, I want to tell you about what's happening in my hospital, my school, are very unlikely to tell you that if you force them to use their own names. So if you've got a way of verifying that information and treating them as off-the-record sources, the chances are that you will get information that is valuable that would be suppressed. And finally, is that there's the practical thing that most people are accessing the internet while they're at work. And the quickest way of cutting off all traffic and all interaction would be to insist that people outed themselves to their employers by using their real names.
It's very honest of you, but yes, that is a major reason. We also experienced one thing during the delivery of the Olympic torch for the Chinese Olympics, that some of our users made comments under nicknames that were critical of China, and they got bashed in Chinese state media, where we thought, thank God they didn't make this comment under their real name. I think what is also very illuminating is what's happening with Facebook, where the theory was that under their real names, people would make comments of much higher quality, and we noticed that this does not happen to be true. We don't see a difference between that. The lady in the background, I think. I can barely see you, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Matt Tempest.
The gentleman in the background.
Yes, indeed. Matt Tempest from Deutsche Presseagentur, and I have a question and a confession. And the confession is, I used to work for Allen and for The Guardian in the very early days of the internet, 2000, 2001, before Twitter and before live blogging. And I can vouch everything he says is true. It was, I remember after 9/11 going, I think, from 1 million to 2 million readers very quickly as the sort of English language, non-American trusted news outlet. And so I think if you offered anybody in the journalism business 1 million readers in 2001 and 37 million readers in 2010, that is a very exciting time to be living in journalism with or without a business model. My question is about data journalism, which we haven't really touched on yet, but is a sort of opening field. And although I'm a fan of it, I just wonder if it's been slightly hyped in the last 12 months or so, in the sense that 3 months or whatever it is after the WikiLeaks Pentagon papers, I mean, as a professional journalist myself, I still haven't read any of those papers because I want somebody to go through them and analyze them for me and tell me what the story is. which is to go back to the idea of the journalist as a storyteller. If you could comment on that.
I completely agree with that, and it, in a sense it touches on the question about investigative journalism. So what WikiLeaks was doing was completely different from what we were doing. So they just had this amazing treasure trove of stuff, and they had no idea what it was or what it meant, and they were about to just release it indiscriminately. And that, I think, would have had no impact at all because, as you say, who's got the time to go through 250,000 documents and impose a pattern on it, or who has the knowledge? And it took us about six people and a month and the technology people who could get into it and make it, you know, could open these documents up, and then the data visualizers who could do something else in order. So it was a huge journalistic exercise to try and make sense of this raw data. Now, I mean, no news organization is going to have the capacity to do that endlessly, which is why we're, again, it comes back to being open and collaborative. There is going to be a mass of data released. That's going to be, you know, another story of our time. So the British government's about to release another 4 million data sets, having released 1.5 million data sets earlier in the year. So this trend towards transparency and releasing data is going to be enormous. And which are the news organisations that are set up to deal with that and make sense of it? And I really believe there is money in this. There is money in having the skills to take data and visualize it, make sense of it, and then sell it on. But most news organizations aren't remotely there yet. And again, I think there's a value in putting it all there and saying, here it is, see what you can do with it, and have an open API and an open platform in which you can harness people who can come and do interesting things with that data and then bring it back.
We don't have that much time left, and I'd like to come to that topic that was the highest rated in our poll, which was future models of funding journalism. Now, Alan, let's speak about the real topic tonight. How do we finance all this? Seriously, how... Let's put the Scott Trust away. How would the Guardian fare without the Scott Trust? What business model might you veer towards?
The honest answer is nobody knows. So we can cut short. So Rupert Murdoch doesn't know, and I don't know. So and let's not pretend that anybody does know. So we can be honest like that. I mean, if it's an argument about closed versus open, all we can go on is the sort of facts at the moment. So the Guardian last year made around £40 million out of its digital, £40 million out of its digital enterprises. Our managing director was speaking at a conference last week, and he said our online display revenues were up 50% year on year.
So 50.
50%, yeah, it's more than 50%. So we all know that that's worth less than adverts in print. 40 million a year is not trivial in terms of money, but it's not going to sustain the future of the Guardian yet. But it's a line that's going up like that. When I talked to the editor of the Sunday Times back in London back in March, and they were about to disappear behind the paywall, he was talking about an ambition for 100,000 readers, which would bring in gross revenues of 10 million. And for that, you sacrifice 95% of the audience. Now, nobody knows what the Times figures are because they haven't released them, but let's take him at his word and say that was their expectation. So it's not evident to me that the charging route is better than the open route. So, I mean, the evidence seems to be that getting a very large audience and putting advertising and sponsorship and behind it is quite successful in earning quite large sums of money. B, we're not opposed to charging for anything, and anything that we can do in terms of functionality for apps or selling data or segmenting the audience, we will charge people for. And the third thing is, I think those of us who are on the open side of this argument just need to sort of talk it up a bit. You know, Rupert Murdoch only has to sort of stand up and pronounce, and you see everybody stampeding over to that side of the ship as though that's the self-evident truth about the future of the business. And I just don't think it is. But if we're trying to persuade advertisers and people who might fund us that there is a future for what we do, then we have to be a bit optimistic about it. And I feel very optimistic about journalism. I feel passionately that we should be talking up the open networked model and saying, let's build an open networked platform that everybody can join over here instead of rushing over there to rebuild the walls that I think are just not going to work. So that's not a solution, but it's a direction of travel.
There's a question back there.
Well, trust I pay in advance, respect I can pay afterwards. For example, after reading an article, I can pay. What do you think about social payment? I mean, I think the famous names are Flatter or Cashingle. So what do you think about the idea that paying respect in an easy system could be some aspect to refinance journalistic work? And the other thing is, what do you think about crowdsourced articles like Spot Us, a platform where you can say, I want to write an article about this and I need this money for that, and then people giving you donations that you can do this article? So two questions, like social payment, Flatter, Cashingle, and the other thing is like crowdsourcing. Something for a newspaper?
Let's try them all. I think they're all genuinely interesting things, and it's perfectly understandable reasons. We're all impatient and anxious about this, and most of us now, and I include the Times and the Sunday Times, and the Independent, and you know, most and the Washington Post. The Washington Post is living on some form of subsidy. The New York Times is effectively, and so we're all puzzling our way through it. But I don't think we're going to solve this immediately, which is why I'm very glad tonight that we started talking about the journalism, because I think if we think about the journalism and what is inspiring and necessary and useful and open and collaborative, that will lead us to the answer. People are going to have different models. And you know, maybe there's something that works on a subscription model with Sky TV that won't work for us, and vice versa. But I think we should just let's just try everything at the moment. But be clear which side of the argument you're on.
Speaking of subsidized journalism, there's another large subsidized journalistic institution called the BBC. And the attacks against the BBC by publishers like Murdoch seem to be relentless. They are also relentless in Germany, but I think not as vitriolic as in the UK. What do you think about this argument that if only the public broadcasters would not be active on the web for free, print media websites would fare better?
Well, there clearly is a danger that the BBC gets too large, and I think actually the BBC would confess that they grew a little too large, a little too fast, that they got into areas where they had no need to be and they probably had no business to be. So I think they are withdrawing from some of those areas. But the BBC is still, to my mind, the greatest news organisation in the world, and is incredibly popular. It has huge levels of trust, 80 and 90% levels of trust. It does serious journalism, to my mind, like no one else in the world. And that's something incredibly precious. So it's terribly easy to blame it for the difficulties that newspapers have. But you go to America, there's no BBC in America, and the newspapers are in even bigger trouble. So you could, on dogmatic reasons or out of fear, try to dismantle the BBC in the hope that that was going to save newspapers. And my strong feeling is it would make absolutely no difference at all. And meanwhile, you would have destroyed something which is incredibly precious, and you would never be able to rebuild.
You're the chief editor. I sometimes forget, to be honest, because I'm so inspired by what you and your team are doing online, but you're the chief editor of a printed daily newspaper. What future do daily newspapers have? Is there a business case at least for a few to survive? And if so, how will their editorial culture have to change to thrive in an internet-dominated media sphere?
Well, my answer to that always used to be, I don't know and I don't care. I mean, I grew up with print. I love print, and I can see the wonderful value of print, and it does things that online can't do. So I'm a complete enthusiast for print.
Just a second, could you elaborate on what print can that online?
Well,
cannot?
I think print has the ability to. It does at least two things that online doesn't do. It has a single moment of publication at a very influential audience, and has a sort of political impact that is not always, which is just different from online. And the second is it is a highly edited collection of you know, it's a very thin selection of pieces, the highly edited version of the world, and that's a very useful thing. It's, you know, I think it's a wonderful thing, and I can make the argument that says it leads you to being a better citizen if you're widely informed about all these subjects, and that would lead you to make better voting choices, and then you get a better democracy from reading newspapers. I believe all that. The trouble is that fewer and fewer readers do, and so if people are unwilling in future to buy or pay for that, and are voting with their feet by then you have to take your product where the audience is, and I think online is doing incredibly potent, wonderful things too. So to that sense, I'm completely neutral. I don't it doesn't worry me how people want to consume The Guardian, as long as I'm producing something that is recognisably The Guardian and, you know, is true to the values. The one thing that has changed my thinking recently is, as the economics bite, that luxury of just saying we're going to do everything in all media is becoming more difficult. I suspect we're all going to have to start making tougher choices. And I suspect those tougher choices are about doing different things in print or doing less in print, simply because, you know, all the questions tonight have been about, you know, how do you get your resources into mobile? How do you get resources into moderating? How do you get your resources into crowdsourcing? And those are really good questions, but if you're going to put your resources over there on the same budget or a declining budget, you can't have them over there at the same time. So I think those are the kind of uncomfortable questions that are now being forced on us, whereas in a sense we had that sort of rather wonderful period where we were all doing everything.
I was, of course, asking also from that privileged position of someone who is working in a team of a printed weekly newspaper, not a daily, where we think this is an ideal combination and it's actually growing. But it also leads to asking, would it be an option to turn The Guardian into a weekly?
Well, if I gave you an answer that looked anything like a yes,
it would be
Twitter would go into meltdown, and everyone would be saying. So I can't think what the answer to that. I mean, if I gave you the answer, well, anything is possible. Somebody will be tweeting saying, the editor of The Guardian says it's possible The Guardian won't be a newspaper. But you know what I'm saying. You know, I mean, I just think all things are possible.
We can read between the tweets, as we say.
Please don't tweet that.
By the way, is somebody monitoring Twitter tonight, the hashtag #ZonDebatte? Is there maybe a topic being mentioned that we totally missed out so far we should speak about? Could you just tell us? Just a second, the mic is on its way.
So, Mercedes-Benz said not long ago that the main challenge won't be print versus online, but app versus text, which means we need to find new ways to incorporate audiovisual media like video and audio into our daily news. So, could you elaborate a bit on that?
App versus what?
So your question is, did you also leave that question in the online poll about how to integrate multimedia journalism into daily operations?
No, I didn't. But,
That is your question, how to integrate multimedia journalism on a more frequent basis. Yeah. Is that right?
And was it also app versus web? Was that the question?
No, app versus text was app really like app versus app means a text with video or audio versus just text.
Okay. Oh.
Well, you see, I think this is why, you know, going back to the original question, you know, what do you tell your daughter about journalism at the moment? You know, what a brilliant time to be a journalist that you can ask these questions. I don't know how old you are, but you know, I grew up at a time where it was text and smudgy black and white pictures, you know, and suddenly you've got brilliant colour pictures, and you've got picture galleries, and then you can put sound with picture galleries, and then you can link, and then you've got the ability to start shooting moving pictures, and then we're experimenting with everything from half an hour films to hour long films to 5 second clips. We're doing podcasting. We do about 20 hours of podcasting a week. We're incorporating video into commenting. So we're experimenting with all of these things, but I mean, what a brilliantly exciting time to be able to. I mean, that's why I think this Gutenberg parallel keeps coming back. This journalism is there for us to reinvent it, and you know, I could give you a very long answer about all the things we're doing in multimedia. Do I believe that multimedia is an essential bit of the future story of newspapers? Yes. Have we cracked it definitively? No. Is it the most exciting thing to be experimenting with in terms of telling stories more effectively, completely, and linking it in with video and response? So it's just such an inspiring time to be a journalist.
So on a very practical level, lower the barriers of entry. Yes, of course, you need professional video editors like our colleagues sitting on the first row who you might want to maybe talk with each other later tonight. But besides, you also need to be able to equip every editor who is interested in it with a flip camera, for instance, and ideally give it to your editors to use them at home and in their vacations and holidays so that they shoot the things that they really like and are interested in and get more experience in a playful manner. The wonderful thing is the equipment is not the barrier anymore. The equipment has become so affordable that you can do it on a shoestring.
But what are releasing for photographers? You know, photographers, you know, the best photographers on The Guardian, who, you know, till 5 years ago were just used to sitting behind a camera and recording pictures, and who now have discovered authorial voices. You know, you send them to China, or you send them to Afghanistan, and they come back with films and points of view, and they've been released by this, and you know, you completely reinterpret the way you think of camera men and camera women and stills and video. It's such a time of fluid invention.
We'll soon have to wrap it up. This is your last chance to ask some more questions. And, of course, later we would be happy to welcome all of you for a little reception. We'll have wonderful wine, snacks. But while we are up here, this is a last round of questions for you. You have asked so many questions already, so I'd like to give the other guests
Sorry,
an opportunity.
So, because I think the answer, I wasn't satisfied with your let's try everything. I mean, we are talking about payment of journalism and thinking of alternatives walled gardens or whatever classical publishers think should do. I mean, we have in France and in Germany lobbying, the publishers are lobbying that printed newspapers are getting paid. I mean, the government is paying for printed newspapers in France, and we're not far away from that in Germany. So talking about payment, and especially about social payment, because when we talk about money, we talk about the power of journalism, because that's what you need, of course. So I'm not satisfied with a let's try everything in such an important subject. I mean, I think the government should, for example, in Germany say, should embrace social payment versions. Like, okay, everybody is giving like 10 euros or 15 euros a month into an account, and then you can easily flatter or cashingle or whatever solution they will find it. And this would give... apps are endangering the free web. So there are some people who didn't understand the internet, like Mr. Döpfner, who think that apps are the savior for journalism. They are not. Apps are a trap. They are a trap for the free web and also for journalism who embraces collaboration and participation like you do. So I think we should a little bit more put more political pressure, also from the publisher side, to the aspect of other payments. For example, like paying respect with a few cent with a convenient system like social payment is offering. So the answer, like, yeah, let's try everything, I think is wrong, because it's about the power of journalism, and therefore you need money, so you have to take this more serious.
But if I may just jump in, if by your insisting on this one solution, you're doing the same thing that you're accusing Döpfner of, which is that the monocausal approach, this will save it. He says apps or paywalls or reducing public broadcasters on the net, and you say it's kachingle. Don't you think that we must, given that we don't know what will work, that we must try everything?
Yeah, but the difference between social payment and payment in advance is that social payment is maybe more, a little bit more like the web is functioning also in interaction.
What's social about it if my government forces me to put another 10 euros
into embraces, not forcing me, but embraces the people to say, if you like journalism, have an account. It doesn't have to be Kashingle or Flatter. It could be a German version of it, whatever. I don't care. Just that to crack the way of payment, yeah, to give the payment to the people who respect what you write. And that's, I think it's really a power question,
I gave you a flippant response. I hesitate to get drawn into these questions about money, because in a sense, I don't know how to make money. You know, I'm a journalist, and at no point during the 190 year history of the Guardian was the editor required to make the money. You know, there was a, and those aren't my skills. But in the end, there always is a question about the money. I like your idea very much, and I would really like to believe it's true. There are versions like NPR. You could say if you live in the States and you listen to National Public Radio for any period of the time, you get used to the regular cycle of giving, and it becomes, at first it's quite sort of shocking that the station is sort of begging its readers to give them money, but after a while you get used to it, and it becomes part of listening to NPR. I think what I'm trying to do with The Guardian, when I use this term mutualize, which is, it's an unsatisfactory word in some ways, but it gets at what I'm trying to do. And when I said that The Guardian, at the moment it feels like little forest fires going off all over the place as people are trying and really finding these techniques of social journalism incredibly rewarding and effective. And I think where I'm going to with this idea is what you're suggesting, so that you can build somewhere where the division between the journalist and the readers is much less than it was, and people feel this is not journalism that is being done to them, that this is something that they can be involved in and they can build, and that might lead to a thing which is, you know, a bit like Barcelona Football Club or John Lewis or these mutualized institutions where you then feel so involved that you then want to pay meaningful sums of money. That would be wonderful. And you know, if we could turn the Guardian into that and it worked as an economic model, no one would be happier than me. I'm just cautious, again, of sort of evangelizing about that because it might be completely unrealistic and we're not going to do it in the next 3 years. But I think, but certainly by doing more of the things that we're doing and building more of an involved audience, I think is the way to get to that point in which you might get that kind of response of people who would give money on that basis.
Quick last question and then I will try to sum it up.
Maybe it's good for a last question. I miss in these discussions a little bit the quality of what we produce. Journalism for me is a craft. And in print journalism, it's about well-written, well-researched stories. And I wonder when we are going to start to open up the borders of our papers. If I find a nice article in The Guardian or in Süddeutsche Zeitung, I often wonder why is not everybody able to read it, to buy it. So when are you going to open up The Guardian and sell the best articles that your colleagues produce to the whole audience? You understand my concept?
I think so, but just try again, because I maybe...
I think it's... If you speak about we have less and less people on our staff, it's about quality of journalism that should be spread further than within the borders of a certain paper. I guess in London you have 8 papers or 10 papers. So how many people read more than 1 or 2? And I wonder if somebody does an in-depth research for an article, why can he or she not sell it to the whole country, to every reader? Why don't you open up your payment in terms of selling? And this adds to the question of the colleague over there, selling single pieces, like the music industry started selling single pieces, and that was a big success and saving some parts of the music industry rather than trying to save labels or discs.
Selling individual articles online, micropayments, is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. I don't want to be accused of glibness as I was before, but I think that's also an idea worth trying. I mean, I suspect The Guardian at the moment, we're trying everything. So one, we're trying everything from self-publishing to the opposite, which is investigative journalists who work for 6 months on something that is highly edited. We've got people who are blogging, but are lightly edited. We've got news reporters who are going through the traditional editing process and go through four hands, go through four different sets of sub-editing. So we're trying everything on this spectrum. And at this end of it, of the self-publishing and the blogging, I think we will be building people either around individuals or around pieces of work.
I'm not talking about blogging. I'm talking about professional journalists who do a good job and could sell their work much further than within Die Zeit or within The Guardian. It works for the photo industry, it works for the soap industry, it works for all the industries. So your best goods, it's a quality that you can sell. I don't talk about all the news that are being spread by BBC and all the free online services, but in-depth stories like the Wikipedia Pentagon story you told us about. Why can't we open the market for those quality products that we produce? And you talked about your colleagues at The Guardian who are doing that kind of jobs. I figure something for these pieces, like a world paper that are being translated in several languages and simultaneously published for the whole world audience. Why can't I read every day the best pieces of the Chicago Tribune if they are not on the web? Why can't I see the best pieces of The Guardian that are printed?
I would love to do that, and I'm sure that many people, for quality, it's about the fun and the interest of reading as well. I would pay, and many people would. Why would I pay 30 euros for the Süddeutsche Zeitung every month? Because I like to read it. Thank you.
I think, I think the answer is that people are trying that. And there are people who are trying to find all kinds of combinations and platforms of reporting and subjects and individuals and articles. And you know, good luck to anybody who can do it. You know, genuinely, I mean, all I can come tonight is to describe what we're trying to do, which is a different kind of distributed model. But anybody who can come up with a different idea, and your idea might be one. Let's hope that it works.
Maybe we can continue this discussion at a glass of wine. I will try to, and it's impossible to do, but I will try to sum up what we heard tonight from you. You absolutely would recommend your daughter to go into journalism because you think journalism has a great future ahead. Maybe journalism is even heading into its golden age because so many things can now be done that couldn't be done before. One, because we can now collaborate with our audience, with readers that are really smart, that would like to practice forms of journalism, not because they want to make money with it, but because of it as a societal motivation and engagement. You think that a whole new form of journalism will emerge due to the release of massive amounts of data that will also lead to forms of data journalism we haven't known before. You find it very exciting that also multimedia journalism is so much easier now also to produce than only a few years ago. You think that culture change in newsrooms is a question of really painting a realistic picture of what's to come for print publications, at least for daily publications and publications in the UK, but also not just using scare tactics, to be blunt, but to also really show what's in it for journalism, things that could not be done before. In regards to public broadcasters and the BBC, I heard a slight criticism of their size and their bureaucracy and the many areas they're engaged in, but it sounded like you would not want to miss public broadcasting and think that this subsidized model of journalism and also the quality that the BBC is putting out justifies its future existence. In regards to different business models and also micropayments, Spot Us, Kachingle, Flatter, and so forth, you strongly object the idea of the one solution, and we should all run towards that, but that we are in a phase where we'll have to try pretty much everything. You are amazingly relaxed. I wish I was as cool as you are when it comes to future profit scenarios. I think that's very healthy and maybe also explains why you're at this for such a long time now already. Being able to sleep is an important strength for a chief editor. I think that was pretty much it. And also in regards to what you said about social media, is you willingly accept the blurring of these old delineations between the journalist as the professional and the journalist as a private person. You say that pretty much doesn't exist anymore. But you don't see an alternative to it. And when we spoke about what once was called user-generated content, it's a bit out of fashion, but working with readers, users, those who once were known as the audience, that the quality is very high when it comes to fact-checking, that yes, of course, there's a duty for us to fact-check and verify like with any other source, but that the quality of this collective source is much higher than what one might anticipate. That's amazing, pretty much what I will take with.
You should be a journalist.
Yeah, I'm working
on that.
That
was very good, wasn't it?
Is there something you would like to add?
He could be a reporter one day. That was very good. No, that was a perfect summary. Sounds quite exciting.
Good. Thank you.